Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 16, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing conservative principles for environmental reform. I'm Christian Corrigan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome to our program two experts. Jonathan H. Adler is a professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. A prolific writer, he is one of the most widely cited academics in environmental law. Our second expert, Professor Donald Koshin of Chapman University School of Law, where his scholarship focuses on law and economics, international law, property, and jurisprudence, among others. Both professors are leaders of the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group. Our principal topic of discussion today will be Professor Adler's essay titled Conservative Principles for Environmental Reform, in which he critiques the regulatory architecture and traditional approaches to environmental policy put in place in the 1970s. A link to that article was provided in notice of today's call and is available on the Federalist Society's website. With that, Professor Adler, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Well, thank you for that introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. Just a little bit of introduction to the subject. This essay was part of a symposium that was sponsored by the Duke Environmental Law and Policy Forum on conservative visions of our environmental future. And so what I was asked to do for this conference was to talk about what a conservative approach to environmental policy would look like. And this is certainly something that I've touched on in my scholarship for the past dozen years or so. And I start from the proposition that I think is relatively non-controversial, that much of existing environmental policy is outdated and in need of reform. Most of the major environmental laws that are on the books were enacted in the 1970s, and with relatively few exceptions, they have not been modernized and kept up to date. These laws reflect the priorities and environmental concerns that were dominant at the time. They reflected certain beliefs about what the nature of environmental problems were and how best to go about them, or how best to go about addressing them. And since then, we've learned a lot about what actually works and what doesn't work. And we've also realized that many of the things that we've done in the name of the environment have other consequences that people don't like and that are controversial. The other starting point for my essay is the observation that particularly in the political arena, most people on the right side of the political spectrum have not really taken environmental problems and environmental policy very seriously. On the right, with the exception of a handful of people in academia, and a handful of people at libertarian-leaning think tanks have adopted one of two approaches to environmental problems, neither of which is particularly satisfactory, particularly inspiring, or a positive road to go down to seek environmental reform. These two dominant approaches are, on the one hand, what I characterize as kind of a moderate me-tooism, and on the other hand, a reactionary opposition. The moderate me-tooism is the habit that many folks on the right have of saying that they accept environmental goals, they accept the need for action, they just want things to cost a little bit less or be a little bit more efficient. It tends to be, you know, we'll do what the Sierra Club wants if we can take 10% off the top. That is not only not very inspiring politically, but it doesn't address or deal with what are some of the real flaws and deficiencies in the dominant approach to environmental policy. It results in folks like the first President Bush campaigning to be the environmental president and saying that, you know, he'll support more regulation as long as it's not quite as much as what Democrats had asked for. And one fatal flaw in this approach to environmental protection is that if you accept the dominant diagnosis of environmental problems put forward by progressive environmentalist groups, it's not a very strong position to say, I accept everything they're saying as long as we can do it more cheaply. If the problems are as severe as is claimed and the sorts of solutions that are needed are, in fact, what are called for, there's not much to be gained by simply trying to do it on the cheap. The alternative approach that's often put forward is equally unsatisfying, and what I characterize as reactionary opposition is the posture, again, that we often see in the political arena of essentially saying whatever the Sierra Club wants or whatever Al Gore wants, we're against, and on top of that, we don't even believe that what they're saying is true. And it's no doubt the case that environmentalist organizations have over time often raised false alarms, often exaggerated environmental threats. But there are serious and real environmental threats. There are real environmental problems. And just because these groups have cried wolf before does not mean that there aren't wolves out there. And on top of that, the reactionary opposition tends to develop a posture where the assumption is that not only are the policy recommendations of progressive environmentalist groups wrong, but the underlying scientific and other premises of their concern must be wrong as well. And at times it kind of leans into an almost abject denialism of any environmental concern that could be raised. And given that, you know, most Americans do consider themselves to be generically pro-environment, do want to breathe clean air and drink clean water, do want to protect the majestic aesthetic beauty of our nation, there's not a lot to be gained by simply opposing in a knee-jerk fashion anything that is labeled green or environmental. But the question then is, what's the alternative? And what I try and do in this essay is outline an alternative vision that takes environmental problems seriously, that recognizes that environmental problems are real, that need to be addressed, and that there are changes, that policy changes that governments must make in order for us to be able to address environmental problems. But at the same time, is true to a traditional conservative commitment to limited government, to the protection of property rights, and a belief in the importance of markets and voluntary exchange protected by the rule of law. And in this essay, and I'm not the first person to have tried to do this, folks like my former boss, Fred Smith, or Terry Anderson out at the Property and Environment Research Center have also articulated a vision of free market environmentalism that's built on similar principles. But the idea is that in many cases, the best thing we can do to the environment is not do what progressive environmentalist groups tend to do, which is say that the problem is markets, the problem is economics, the problem is property rights, and so these things must be controlled and government must be expanded. But in fact, in many instances, the best way to deal with environmental problems is to take the principles of limited government and property rights more seriously and to embody them into environmental policy. And so in the last part of the essay, what I try and do is articulate some principles that I think could serve as a practical guide to what right-leaning policymakers should do to both take environmental issues and environmental problems seriously, but also stay true to conservative principles. And so I'll briefly go through those principles before turning it over to Don. The first of those principles is kind of an environmental Hippocratic oath, a first do no harm. And the idea here is that one of the perversities of existing governmental policy is that the government, the federal government in particular, but also in many cases state governments as well, spend millions of taxpayer dollars subsidizing, encouraging, or creating environmental problems that the same governments are then going to spend more taxpayer dollars and enact many regulations to then try to address. And this makes no sense. In many areas, the best thing we can do for the environment and the first thing we should do is to scale back, if not completely eliminate, those government programs that are subsidizing or encouraging or creating environmental harm. Agricultural subsidies are Exhibit A, but there are all sorts of policies out there, from the way we deal with managing public lands to the subsidizing of development in certain ecologically sensitive areas, where the government is actively making our environmental challenge worse than it needs to be. The second principle is green through growth, and it's the idea that markets left to their own devices produce many environmentally positive outcomes that we should be encouraging. This is both true in the sense that markets encourage economic growth, which generate the wealth that is necessary to address many environmental problems, and the technological advance that's necessary to address environmental problems. But also, it stems from the observation that concern for many environmental problems tends to correlate with economic well-being. And there have been studies both in the United States, but as well as cross-national studies, that show that holding all else equal, encouraging economic growth through market-driven processes is in itself one way to increase efficiency, which increases the efficiency of resource use. The competitive pressures of the marketplace inevitably encourage actors to do more with less, and there are environmental benefits of that. So replacing copper wire with fiber optics and then replacing fiber optics with various wireless technologies was driven by the market process and competitive pressures. But the environmental benefits of those sorts of transitions are tremendously important, and we need to recognize that insofar as we constrain markets, we risk sacrificing those sorts of benefits. The third principle is a commitment to the protection of private property rights and the expansion of property institutions. We should be protecting private property rights not merely from government expropriation and excessive government regulation, but also from other private actions which can harm property rights. When we look around the world, we tend to see that those environmental resources which are most fully incorporated into property institutions are those that are managed in the most sustainable way and that are least in need of government protection. And so it's important to try and find ways to expand property institutions, as has been proposed, for example, with fisheries, as well as to ensure that those property rights are secure, and that includes full protection under the Fifth Amendment. In some of my research, I've written about how under laws like the Endangered Species Act, the regulation of private property and the in many cases, punitive regulation of private property can actually discourage the sort of ecological stewardship that we want private landowners to engage in. And given that most of the land in the United States is still privately owned, most of the land that is necessary, for example, for species conservation is privately owned, we need to ensure that we are encouraging stewardship and security of property rights is necessary for that. The fourth principle is really just an extension of the commitment to property rights, which is making the polluter pay. And by that, I don't mean pile on lots of fees and costs on those that engage in productive activity. What I mean is make sure that private actors are held responsible for the harms that they cause. Pollution is not merely the creation of a waste residual. Pollution is the imposition of a waste residual, of an emission, upon the person or property of another without their consent. We shouldn't be focused on the fact that one company contracts with another company to take its residuals and recycle them or dispose of them or whatever else. We should be concerned about when one economic actor imposes costs on another. And this is a principle that has always been at the heart of the common law protection of property rights. The first reported case of protecting a private landowner against the harmful actions of another private landowner is at least 400 years old. This is not a new idea. And it means that the conservatives should be perfectly comfortable with liability rules that hold those engaged in potentially harmful behavior accountable, and other policies that make sure that folks are held accountable for the actual harms they cause. And in my view, one of the big deficiencies of the current system environmental regulation is that we tend to focus on whether or not a company has a permit or whether or not there was an emission. And we don't actually focus on what should really matter, which is whether or not there's a harm, whether or not there's something that could be recognized as a property rights violation. And the last principle, and the principles that I propose is decentralized environmental decision making. And I propose this for a couple of reasons. One is that we need to recognize that environmental policy is tough and environmental problems are difficult. And in a lot of cases, we may have a general idea of the sorts of reforms that are desirable, but that the actual implementation could be difficult, and it's important to, where possible, to ensure that the laboratories of democracy are open and that different states have the ability to experiment with trying different ways of taking some of these other principles and putting them into practice. This principle also comes from a recognition that most environmental problems, most of the things that the environmental portions of the U.S. Code are focused on, are actually local or regional in nature. There certainly are problems that are global. There certainly are problems that affect large regions or large portions of the country. But if you actually go line by line through the portions of the U.S. Code and look at the federal environmental law, we see most of it is concerned with things that are relatively localized and that don't really need to be addressed at the federal level. And one principle that I think one can derive from our constitutional structure is that the federal government should be focused on those things that truly have a federal character or an interstate character, and that those things that are more localized are the sorts of things that should be left to state and local governments. We've gotten away from that in environmental policy, but getting back to that would both allow for more experimentation in the development of environmental policies, but also make it easier for the federal government to do those things where a federal role is necessary in a more effective and efficient manner. I've probably gone on a little longer than my initial allotted time, so I will pause there and turn it over to Don.
Thank you, Professor Edler, and thank you to the Federal Society for asking me to comment on this important issue. I want to thank Professor Edler for his opening comments as well as producing this important new article, which fits in, as he said, a larger body of work that helps contribute to this scholarly and political debate on what role is there for conservative or market-based solutions in the environmental debate. I am going to proceed to elaborate on a couple of the points made in Professor Adler's presentation and paper, and then sort of at the second half of my comments discuss some of the hurdles to the implementation of a conservative vision, in that the process itself poses some questions as to the realistic ability to realize a conservative environmental vision in light of our current state. The traditional themes of conservative thought of private ownership and the assignment of rights and responsibilities with limited government and decentralized government influence all play a role in identifying the proper way to eliminate environmental harm. And I think one of the key principles or themes within that conservative body of thought is that idea of self-interest, personal responsibility, and incentives. So I want to say a bit about the polluter pays concept and just elaborate a bit on how that might be accomplished. It seems to me that the polluter pays concept does create a liability system rather than a regulatory one that focuses on this idea of self-interest, personal responsibility, incentivizes persons, and makes them better allocate the cost of environmental protection, or focused, as Jonathan said, on harm rather than on sort of preemptive regulations and permitting processes. The polluter pays system could take a variety of forms, some of which are discussed in the paper, taxation systems. I could see this happening through tradable pollution rights or pollution rights that are purchased and then traded so that those who aren't actually causing harm can sell those rights away to the others who might, and we can have some sort of proper allocation of that system. Or you could do a straight liability regime using the common law, for example. All in all, though, it's not allowing individuals to escape pollution controls, but instead, quite the contrary, it's just fairly allocating the responsibility to the appropriate individuals. Of course, the big problem with any of this is reaching agreement or deciding who decides what constitutes pollution and what levels would require payment. From this, of course, we can borrow from the common law and borrow from our traditional concepts of nuisance as to what pollution should be. And we can also borrow from the common law and use it, or we can borrow from the common law and use other state-based regimes like the taxation regime or tradable permits or credits. But there needs to be some way to identify what we agree on as pollution, and I think that's a bit of a barrier, especially if we're going to trust those decisions to institutions other than sort of the traditional notions of what would constitute a nuisance at common law. One mechanism that might be interesting to approach in relation to polluter pays would also be a bonding system, bonding such as we see in the mining laws and mining reclamation laws, in which bonds are required to be put up ahead of time so that if persons don't actually control their environmental degradation or reclaim their properties, then the bonding system can in fact force them to pay. They're just sort of putting up that insurance ahead of time. Of course, with the mining situation, some of the reclamation requirements are overly intrusive, and you also have a coupled with prescriptive regulation, so it's not a pure polluter pays. But bonding systems could be a way in which we could adapt toward a system like that. Another interesting thing I could see coming out of a greater attention given to polluter pays would be the rise of watchdog groups that might first off expose those polluters as liable, gather evidence, and coordinate litigation, perhaps, as to those who should be held responsible for polluting. And these watchdog groups could be funded by those persons who, seemingly, in society, are interested in environmental protection and could serve as a sort of civic-oriented or civic-minded police force, or it could also be done in a way in which they get a certain percentage of the recoveries or what have you, but a means by which those watchdog groups could facilitate this in a private enforcement means and not necessarily through this other governmental prescriptive means. So I think it's an exciting way to look at fairly allocating the responsibilities of individuals. The second sort of thing I wanted to elaborate on was the concept of the public lands discussion in the paper, because I think the public lands issue deals with a mix of both the first do no harm principle and also the decentralization principle. There needs to be a conservative vision for a better and more efficient and more sensible management of our public lands. And in that, given that 31% of the nation's lands are owned by the federal government, one of the key ways is some form of decentralization. Decentralization both into private hands as well as into perhaps state and local hands. So the first way to sort of a conservative vision I could see in relation to public lands to elaborate further on what Jonathan has already said is to return to a disposal ethic. From the founding of this country, we understood that the federal government would own certain lands for purposes that were limited and temporary. And so if we return to this idea that much of this property that's held in the government portfolio should be returned to private hands, we can, in fact, start to create more efficient management regimes in the process. The second is that to the extent that anything is going to be retained in government ownership, I think that ownership and management complexities are best dealt with at a more local level. Our public lands laws provide for some input on the local to local constituencies, but it's certainly complicated by the federal ownership and the federal intervention in much of the management decisions at the local level. This decentralized idea of public lands would move that toward a more concentrated approach to how those lands should be managed, conserved, and otherwise environmentally protected. Another approach to the public lands as well is to consider the idea that they should be open to more development, as well as to piggyback on the property rights concept to encourage more perhaps split estates within public lands so that there can be an efficient allocation of ownership between government ownership and private ownership, perhaps based on the resources that are available and can be extracted from these. The public may be amenable to this in terms of increasing awareness of new technologies, fracking, new ways to extract oil and gas, and other means that the public may in fact support for the idea of energy independence or otherwise. And then the last sort of thing in this vein is that the conservative vision needs to adopt a non-expansionist idea of the public lands at the very least. That is, we see things like the Great Outdoors Initiative, in which there is this concept of preservation and conservation being extended not just to our traditional public lands, but also into urban areas and suburban areas, in which this creep into these areas and this idea of greater preservation based, including federal intervention in such a way in this new Obama Great Outdoors Initiative sort of risks us going in the wrong direction. And so the idea, again, is to adopt the conservative vision to move us more toward the decentralized and private ownership of those lands that are currently held by the government. With that in mind, I want to sort of, as sort of my last elaboration, talk about cost-benefit analysis, because it is one thing that deserves a great amount of criticism on the part of conservatives, I think, is this is over-emphasis on the imposition of procedural cost-benefit analyses. The same can be said of takings impact assessments that many people have probably heard of in relation to takings law and private property, in which the idea is to assess what you're doing and to maybe minimize the impact. But these don't steer us into the conservative alternative, but as Jonathan said, they instead steer us just to the slightly less burdensome liberal alternative. And these have some minimal success at diminishing somewhat the burdens of regulation, but they still presume regulation, and they are informative but not always action-inducing. But I want to go a bit further and say that they also are dangerous in the fact that they provide cover and divert our attention from more substantive reforms. Too often, I believe, conservatives see it as a victory when they get cost-benefit analyses attached to certain statutes or independently required in certain regulations. And as such, that victory has no real success at diminishing the ethic that we're approaching this with. Instead, we're still looking at a progressive type prescriptive ethic, and instead it's sort of a minor victory, and sometimes that victory is celebrated to the detriment of focusing on a more substantive reform. There's a reason why these have been easily obtained politically sometimes, and more easily obtained than grand parts of a conservative environmental vision, in large part because they're easier to get because they have less impact. So I do agree with almost all of Jonathan's comments here and in his paper, but in the spirit of provoking further discussion, I want to highlight a few selected concerns, principally related to the hurdles that conservatives face. So the first has already been identified, that is the absence of an alternative vision. This is a start. We need to get a vision, and as you said, must be engaged. But what level of engagement is another question. Even with a vision, sort of my second point is, even with a vision, much like many market-based ideas, we need explainable mechanisms and mechanics. Ideas into action, and action people can understand and are willing to trust. I think that sometimes, you know, we have a great faith in markets as conservatives that we believe in, but it's difficult for others in the populace to sort of have confidence in the ability for those things to deliver and to understand how exactly it's going to be accomplished. I think that that's something generally which conservatives need to be mindful of as they try and implement their vision. The third burden, or barrier, I should say, it seems to be people and the human psyche. The demand for environmental protection is high, as the paper points out, but the paper is, you know, in large part, that demand for environmental protection also is based in the sort of left-wing idea of what the protection should be. And part of that, I think, is generated by fear, fear of the unknown as to the environmental risks, fear of the dangers of environmental harm, and people are generally, in this sense, risk-averse. They're looking for some sort of safety net, and the government has provided a greater level of confidence and assurance in that sense, and therefore people have been more receptive to the more prescriptive idea of regulating because of its greater, at least, perception of success at preventing the harms that can occur. The other sort of question that I'll pose is to understand this idea of people's disposable income and their willingness to pay for environmental benefits. I think that is entirely true, that when we have more disposable income, the environment is sometimes a luxury and we're willing to pay for it. One of the questions I have, though, is whether or not we've seen a tendency over time with disposable income to also be more willing to tolerate regulation, that is, to be more willing to tolerate the taxes that are imposed upon us as a result of those environmental regulations, and or more willing to pay higher prices as a result of those regulations when we have more disposable income. So does the sort of tendency to prefer environmental outcomes, and when you have more disposable income, translate into investment, private investment, or is it more of a willingness to tolerate greater governmental intrusion? This idea of the barrier in the consumer market as the consumers of environmental protection, reminds me kind of a marketing idea. Marketing tells us that it's not always the person who has the best product that wins the consumer. Sometimes it's the person who has the best salesman or the best sales pitch and that best understands the sensitivities of the consumers, the nature of their demands, and their psychological buttons that need to be pushed. So conservatives need to start, I think, in understanding how they overcome that particular barrier. The fourth barrier that I pose to the overall possibility of reform is the institutions and bureaucracy. Since the 1970s, we've built up a formidable apparatus within the regulatory institutions in the environmental side, and they become entrenched. There is this tendency for bureaucracies to perpetuate themselves and perpetuate their power. They're willing to use their positions to justify their existence, which feeds the public fear, and they want to feed that fear and make themselves feel needed. So there's a great threat the conservative vision presents to these folks, and therefore they're more likely to be use that sort of entrenched status to try and oppose any type of conservative vision. I think that you've seen that that may be one of the reasons why the ideas of the conservative vision have seen less success over time in actual implementation. And finally, also noted in the paper is the strength of the environmental lobby. They're well-financed. The optics are on their side. They have very powerful narratives, as the Cuyahoga River example in the paper illustrates. They, even if it manipulates the facts, it nonetheless becomes a powerful narrative that the lobby attaches to the stories as to why we need the government to become involved, why we need the federal government to become involved in particular. And the greater risk, I guess, is that the environmental lobby is often seen as benign, unlike other interest groups, which are seen as sort of, you know, the evil corporate lobbies. But the environmentalists, they're there on our side, right? They're there for the public good. They're for, there for the public interest. And that optic is difficult to overcome. And I think that it's difficult to overcome for some of these conservatives, which are criticized in the paper, and rightly so, who vote in favor of increased prescriptive regulation, in part because it's very difficult to have a vote that can be portrayed in the newspaper as being against the environment. And so that hurdle, both overcoming the strength of the lobby as well as the sort of pressure that that lobby can put, as well as the optics that the public will might see for the politicians, all become issues that I see as necessary for conservatives to recognize as they try and implement the vision that was identified in the paper. So I'd love to hear any thoughts from both Professor Adler as well as the callers on those comments. But I think that it's very important that we have this conversation and begin to inject this vision into the conversation and reform in that light.
This is Christian Corgan. I'm going to give Professor Adler a minute to respond with any thoughts he has to Professor Koshin's comments. But before we go to Professor Adler, pretty soon we will open up the floor to your questions to our audience. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you'll hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Professor Adler, do you want to give us just a few quick thoughts?
Yes. Yeah, let me just I'll say a couple thoughts. I mean, I think, I'll start with the point that Don made about the concern that as people get wealthier and as disposable income increases, that there is more toleration of regulation. I think that's true to a point, but I would actually describe the phenomenon a little bit differently. As people get wealthier, and we put a lot of data to show this, the demand for what we could characterize as environmental goods or for environmental quality increases, and support for measures that advance environmental protection increases, and a willingness to spend in support of environmental goods increases. So support for local ballot initiatives to purchase green space, or support for or willingness to pay more for products that consumers believe are environmentally beneficial and what have you. That's certainly all true, but I think the key to understanding what's going on in the phenomenon is that there's a willingness to tolerate regulation, but it doesn't necessarily translate into a desire for regulation. The desire that increases, it is a desire for environmental protection. What that means is, and this relates to the issue of a vision, is that if the choice that voters have, or the choice that the public has, is between regulation that makes an effort to protect the environment on the one hand, or doing nothing on the other. Yes, there are some people that will say, whose opposition to regulation is such that they will still want to do nothing. But there are many people, and a group that I think over time grows, that if that's the choice, they'll take the regulation that protects the environment. But many of those people, if given the alternative of another way of protecting the environment, are more than willing to go that alternative route. Back in the 1990s, when I worked at CEI, we commissioned a bunch of polling and focus group work to test this hypothesis, whether or not people would simply give up what often is shown in the polling data as a fairly strong support for the general idea of limited government. Do they simply give that up in the environmental context? Or is it that if forced to choose between a belief in limited government and environmental protection, they will perhaps reluctantly side on environmental protection? And we found that it does appear to be a reluctant choice, that when people are given alternatives, when alternative ways of advancing environmental values are put forward, that pluralities of people would, in fact, go for that third alternative. And we've seen this before in American politics. A good way of thinking about this is looking at the welfare debate. And I'm going to tell the story in an overly stylized way, but I think it makes the point. In the 1970s, the way many, and even in the 1980s, the way many folks on the right talked about welfare was in terms of it being wasteful and perhaps even going to those who were undeserving. And that certainly convinced some portion of the American public, and certainly those people for whom limiting government, the size of government, limiting government spending, balancing the budget, and so on were very high priorities. That was enough. But that wasn't enough to cause any reform of the welfare state. What was necessary was for people to articulate a vision for advancing the goals of the welfare state, helping those in need, showing compassion for our fellow citizens, but in an alternative way, one that doesn't lead to the massive expansion of government and doesn't, as we now understand, create a culture of dependency and so on. So in fact, what was a necessary predicate for welfare reform was people on the right's ability to say, I care about the poor just as much. In fact, it's because I care about the poor that I think we need to reform the welfare state. That's what created a situation where a Democratic president had felt compelled to sign a welfare reform. I believe that same case can be made in many environmental areas, that those who really care about environmental protection more than they care about regulation, more than they care about punishing business, shouldn't want to defend existing environmental programs, but in fact should be those screaming the loudest for reform of environmental programs. And what folks on the right have failed to do is to take advantage of that opportunity, failed to say, the reason I want to reform the Endangered Species Act, the reason I want to give more protection for private landowners isn't because I'm against environmental protection, but because I'm in favor of it. And I'll close with this point. If we look at something like the Endangered Species Act, here's a law that's been on the books now for 40 years. In that period of time, something like 1,800 species have been listed as endangered or threatened, and only a few dozen of those have been delisted. But it turns out as many species have been delisted either because they went extinct or because they never should have been listed in the first place than because they've recovered. So, and it's only a few dozen. But the record is actually worse than that, because when you actually look at the primary regulatory portions of the Endangered Species Act, those portions of the act that constrain private land use in the name of protecting species, those provisions of the act cannot be credited with recovering a single species. And worse, we know that species today, under the Endangered Species Act, tend to be doing worse on private land than on federal land. I believe, and I edited a book a couple of years ago for the American Enterprise Institute called Rebuilding the Ark that lays out this case, that if the goal is actually saving species and not controlling private land use, the Endangered Species Act is indefensible. Now, making this case doesn't alienate those people who don't particularly care about endangered species or just place property rights first anyway, but it does reach those people who care about property rights, care about about land rights and the like, but also care about advancing environmental values. And I certainly put myself in that group. I care about both things. We conservatives have too often bought into this false narrative that the measure of environmental of one's commitment to the environment is one's willingness to expand the size, scope, and power of the federal government. It wasn't true in the welfare context. We recognize today that we don't measure our compassion for our fellow citizens by how much we're willing to expand welfare programs. What we really are missing is leadership that is willing to make that same case in the context of environmental protection.
Thank you very much, Professor Adler. This is Christian Corrigan again. We do have one question on our line that we'll go to in just a minute. But again, if you would like to ask a question, we have one question, and then you'll be able to get to the front of the queue. Press star and then the pound key.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. What this seems to want to lead us toward is examining ways in which constitutional alternatives can be made to seem more attractive than the convenient and easily understood regulatory approaches to these problems. It's easy to sell regulatory approaches because they are easier to understand. But I found in my analysis that for every one of these problems, there is a solution that is constitutional as opposed to regulatory approaches, which generally are not. But they also tend to be very complicated and not easily understood. So what can we do to try to mobilize our ability to present constitutional alternatives that can gain the support that we need in order to displace regulatory approaches?
Okay, a couple of things there. I mean, first, I think it's certainly true that if we took constitutional constraints on government power more seriously, that would certainly, at least on the margin, constrain some of the things that are currently done in the name of environmental protection, and that need not come at the expense of actual environmental protection. And I've written several articles that lay out that case. I don't think it means necessarily explaining more complicated things. I mean, the average person understands that if we're talking about local drinking water, leaving the protection of local drinking water in the hand of state and local governments is perfectly understandable. Saying that the regulators responsible for a certain decision are going to be the people that breathe the same air and drink the same water as the people they're protecting because they're in that community is something that people readily understand. And I think for many environmental problems, when they're put in that way, you tend to see that a lot of people who will tell pollsters that they support increasing environmental protection no matter what the cost will also say, oh, but I have more faith in state and local officials than I do in federal officials to make decisions. It also happens to be the case that I think that there are some environmental issues, like drinking water being a good example, where the argument that the federal government has authority in the first place is a difficult one to make. Now, it's been upheld in federal court, but I do think that's an example of how the case can be made in a way that people understand it. And in terms of a practical way of moving in that direction, I don't believe that the courts are going to be the savior here. I don't expect, and in many respects wouldn't even want, the judiciary to try and remake all of environmental law. That's not really the proper judicial role. But again, looking at other reform efforts, we can see ways to create more space for reforms of environmental policy. And one way to do that would be to create a mechanism in environmental law, and I would recommend doing this across the board with all of the major environmental statutes, whereby state and local jurisdictions could opt out of the existing regulatory structure create a mechanism where the governor of a state or the environmental agency of a state could say, okay, we recognize you think your way of doing it is the best way to meet the needs and demands of our citizens. We believe something else. We would like authorization to opt out of these programs subject to these conditions. And I think creating that sort of process not only would be easier to do than trying to rewrite each environmental statute top to bottom, I also think it alters the political dynamic because it creates an opportunity for state and local governments to benefit from pursuing reform. And so it creates a constituency for reform. And I think that's a necessary piece. So I think, so, for example, if you allowed created a mechanism like this, you would see governors of both parties looking for ways of both maximizing environmental protection, but doing so at less cost or in a way that's more compatible with the demands of their citizens. And the more we observe that process, the easier it would be to make the case for reallocating government authority over environmental problems in a way that's more consistent with our constitutional structure.
If I could just add that I agree with what Jonathan said about the practical and indeed the prudent restraints on having the courts involved in this extensively or a heavy reliance on the courts. In addition, I think that we can't escape the need to alter the regulatory paradigm because even if I understand what the constitutional restraints that you're asking about might be, at least at the federal level, much of them are federalism constraints, et cetera. The paradigm needs to shift both at the federal level, but also at the state levels too. So I think that we need to inject these ideas into all levels of governance, regardless of whether or not they're constitutionally constrained from acting, so that they are going to sort of a wiser environmental management strategy.
This is Christian Corrigan again. We have about 10 minutes left for questions, and we do have two callers on the line, so we'll move quickly to our next question. And to make sure we can get as many questions in as possible, if our callers will do their best to make their questions as brief as possible.
This is Leo Dombrowski in Chicago. Professor Adler, I've got a question for you about the Endangered Species Act and also other environmental statutes in general. You've written a lot and spoken a lot about how the Endangered Species Act sets up this perverse situation where if you're a private landowner, the last thing you want is to get a letter from the Fish and Wildlife Service saying you may have an endangered species on your property, and therefore, you know, you really can't then do much with your property without violating the act, and therefore the last thing you want on your property is habitat that may support an endangered species. So you might do certain things to prevent species from being on your property. It's my opinion that the environmental groups see the environmental, the Endangered Species Act and other statutes, especially with their citizen suit provisions that contain fee shifting provisions, that they see these statutes not as perhaps great ways to protect the environment, but great ways to shut down development of property. And if you're sued under one of these statutes, not only are you paying your own attorney's fees, you may be paying the environmental group's attorney's fees as well. Do you see any interest on the part of environmental groups to revise the statutes, especially the Endangered Species Act, along the lines that you think would be desirable?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, let me say two things. First, and in this essay, I don't really talk about the Washington-based environmental lobby. I in other writings, have been very critical of the leadership of many of the environmentalist groups, which I do think often put their institutional interests or their preference for progressive policies generally ahead of their commitment to environmental protection, and have criticized them for not acknowledging the advances in environmental protection, even under their paradigm, that have been the result of Republican politicians. So, for example, the first President Bush proposed and signed into law the most expansive and comprehensive environmental law we've ever seen, the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, and he got no credit for that from environmental groups. The second President Bush did more in terms of marine conservation, did more of what environmental groups tend to call for in the area of marine conservation than any of his predecessors, got zero credit for it. So there are certainly problems there, and I think the leadership of the Washington-based groups is particularly to blame for this, and I think that there's often a divide between the folks that are part of what is a fairly rigid Democratic Party coalition inside the Beltway from the rank-and-file membership of a lot of these groups. I mean, a lot of people that send their $10 to the Sierra Club or the National Wildlife Federation or whatever else just want to advance environmental values and aren't wedded to which party is in control of the government. In terms of the issue of willingness for reform, I think it comes and goes. There are some areas, fisheries being one of them, where quite a few environmental groups have, in my view, endorsed some pretty strong property-based medicine for dealing with fisheries problems. Unfortunately, it's Republicans that have refused to go along with stuff that's very market-oriented. In areas like the Endangered Species Act, I think there is a private willingness to admit the act's failings, but there is a lack of trust that those that call for reforming these laws actually care about environmental values. So, one of the consequences of the reactionary approach to environmental policy that is so prevalent on the right today is that it doesn't create many opportunities for reform. There are many good reasons why folks on the right don't trust the leadership of the environmentalist groups, but I think there are also good reasons why the leadership of some of these groups don't trust some folks on the right. And I think that is actually a barrier to broader support for some of the sorts of reforms we need.
Professor Koshin, do you care to comment at all?
No, we can go on to the next question.
Okay, great.
This is Bill Severson, Seattle. Professor Adler, you sort of stole a little of my thunder with your last comments, but my concern is that it's conservative libertarian property rights folks are in the public mind sort of linked at the hip with anti-environmental feelings, and that there's a tremendous credibility problem with trying to come up with a libertarian sort of vision for or a property rights-based vision of how to move forward with real pro-environmental policies, but ones that don't rely on the Big Brother sort of regulatory approach. How do we address that problem? Is there any way around that problem? That's my question.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's certainly a difficult problem, and it certainly takes political leadership, and it certainly takes a willingness to make the case that one can support environmental protection without supporting a bigger government. And that, just as again, that I said, that case was made in the context of welfare. I think, as a practical matter, one of the things that folks on the right need to do is to be sure that they are being true to their principles, or just as true to their principles, in the environmental context as in other contexts. I mean, Republicans talk all the time, and in my view, with good reason, about the need to cut the federal budget. So why not make a big public display of identifying and eliminating those government programs which subsidize environmental harm? Now, it may well be that there are some constituencies that are Republican constituencies that don't like that. But it's the failure to do those sorts of things, those things which should be easy, that undermines Republican credibility. If a Republican office holder is not willing to vote against a federal government program that is wasteful, that doesn't clearly fulfill what most conservatives would identify as a true proper function of government, if they're not willing to get rid of that, even when it's also the cause of environmental harm, often the environmental harm that then justifies the creation of additional programs to solve that harm, then if Republicans aren't willing to do that, then it's hard to blame, you know, the average member of an environmental group for wondering whether or not Republicans are anti-environment or not. Because and I think that unfortunately Republicans have found it easy to accommodate constituencies that benefit from government largesse in an environmentally destructive way, and that is is really fatal to their credibility on these issues. Now, as I said before, I wish the environmental community would do more to encourage this. I mean, if I headed an environmental group and my number one goal was protecting the environment, and Republicans had a majority in one of the houses of Congress, well, my first agenda should be, okay, well, what are things that advance environmental protection that a Republican majority might like? And I would make that my priority, not trying to flip the House. A lot of the major environmental groups don't take that approach, and so they shouldn't be surprised that Republicans don't want to talk to them either. So I do think it takes two to tango in that respect. But I think the way you show the public that your interest is in addressing problems in a way that's consistent with traditional limited government principles is by being true to those principles. And again, I think too many times Republicans have said, well, yeah, these farm subsidies are environmentally destructive, and yeah, they're really wasteful, and yeah, they justify the EPA doing all these other things that's really intrusive to landowners and local governments and so on, but a lot of those farmers we think will vote for us, so we're going to protect those programs. I mean, that sort of thing is a real problem.
I'll just add that I agree that the level of consistency on the part of conservatives is key to getting their legitimacy and to having their arguments taken seriously. And so conservatives are against subsidies except when they aren't, and that needs to change. There needs to be a more consistent approach in that regard. I think the second thing to try and educate the public or to remember is that many of the environmental values and the idea of stewardship of land, et cetera, are traditional conservative values. The idea of control of externalities is a property-based idea and based on the common law. These are traditional conservative concepts of protecting your property against intrusions from others. So it's grounded in traditional conservative values, as is efficiency and liability regimes, in which liability is attached to those who cause harm to others, and the allocation of liability creates the most efficient outcomes, and that's always been a conservative theme as well. So I think that there is a misperception that most conservatives or libertarians are not concerned about the environment. I think that many are. And again, it is just this messaging issue, which can only be helped by taking, as Professor Adler said, a more consistent approach.
Great. This is Christian Corrigan again. We have reached the end of our allotted time for the call. So I would like to conclude by just giving each of our experts a minute or so to give any concluding thoughts before we end the call. Professor Adler?
Yeah, the one thought I would just close with is that I don't want to be misunderstood to suggest that these are easy problems, or that all we need to do is snap our fingers. Environmental problems are challenging, but there is good reason to be very dissatisfied with the current approach, not only because it results in costly and intrusive government programs, but also because it doesn't produce the sort of environmental results that we as Americans should want, and that the case can and needs to be made that greater dedication to traditional conservative values of limited government and protection of private property and free markets is actually a way to improve upon the environmental performance of programs, and that one does not and should not have to fall into this false narrative that we so often hear and see in the environmental context, which measures one's commitment to environmental protection by the extent to which one's willing to endorse the expansion of government programs.
I'll just add that I think one of the good valuable contributions of the paper and this discussion is that conservatives need to understand that smart environmental policy can indeed make good politics. And I think that they think that only prescriptive environmental policy makes for their good politics, and the way to change that is to have greater education and more forums like this.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Professors Adler and Koshin for participating on our call today. Two quick programming notes. Our next scheduled Teleforum call will be on Tuesday, May 21st at 2 p.m. on the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bowman versus Monsanto. And then also a programming note to ask you to visit our new blog, www.executivebranchproject.com. That's executivebranchproject.com, which is part of a new executive branch review project for the practice groups of the Federalist Society. Please continue to check our website as well as the blog for updates on future programming. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.